Welcome, FinTech Talkers. Another show recorded live in Money 2020 in Las Vegas. In continuing with my FinTech morphing into FinTel, that is Fin plus AI or Fin plus intelligence, here's my conversation with another FinTel startup CEO, David Nohy. David leads FinGoal, which is focusing on the hyper-personalization ability of AI. As I've said elsewhere, the power of AI, or Gen AI specifically, is the ability to personalize experience. Think of a Netflix show with the actors and the plot just for you, based on your preferences. That is the power that can be unleashed into financial services, and that's what David and team are doing. Welcome, David, to the FinTech Talk Show.
Patty, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So before we get into that hyper-personalization capability, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what made you get in there, what have you done before FinGoal?
Oh, sure. So pre-FinGoal, I am a recovering lawyer. I still pay my bar dues, but I never practiced full-time. I was at Apple back when the original iPhone came out. I got to launch that in the U.S. and over in the U.K., which was wild. I got to watch Steve Jobs chew out my boss one time, which is as close as I ever got. But it was still, wild.
Wow.
Yeah. Last company I started was a payments company, vertically focused in dentistry. So we were solving problems around the affordability and the speed of money movement and financing in dentistry. Grew that for about 5 years. By the time we were done, we were moving about $2 billion a year and originating hundreds of millions of dollars of consumer or patient financing, and then exited to our largest customer, which was a large multi-unit dental practice.
Wow. That's so second startup and payments into AI and personalization, hyper-personalization. So tell us a little bit about what FinGoal does.
Yeah. So I'll share what we do today, and then, you know, as the conversation goes, I'm sure we'll talk about where we're going and, you know, how that relates to where AI is moving the whole industry forward. So today we are in the business of looking at transaction data from account holders. That's credit card, bank transactions, investment transactions, anything in financial accounts, to better understand what's happening in the life of that customer, whether it is a consumer or a business owner. Because who you do business with and who does business with you signals a ton. And today we are focused on taking that signal and using it to determine and predict what, not just what's happened in the life of that customer, but what's going to happen next, and therefore what they need next from the financial institution or financial brand that serves them. So to make that succinct, you send us transaction data, we help you do more business with the customers you have.
Gotcha. So that's incredibly powerful. That's what banks or any business for that matter want to know, right? What's the next best thing or the next next thing that their customers want to do? So are you getting a lot of traction? I presume you're getting a lot of tractions with marketing and CRM and those kind of areas in the bank.
Yeah, it's really within financial services because they have the data, or at least most of the data that we need to get started. Because it is, I need to see as close to a 360 view of where you spend your money and make your money in order to analyze and understand who you are, right? And so banks love that. We're strictly on the analytics side, though. So we typically are selling through CRMs and marketing systems, or broadly what we would call like the experience layer. So that could be like digital and mobile banking platforms along with more like marketing orchestration, experience orchestration.
Yeah. So how do you project it out? So today, if I say go to a bank that's using FinGoal, I'll get very tailored, very specific, almost to take example of Google and Facebook, right? So if I search something, up pop comes an ad when I go to Google again about what's or something on my Gmail, and they kind of mine that. So it's contextual, it's personalized based on what's happening, or in your case, more who I'm dealing with or spending money on and so forth. So how does that move forward besides just offers, right? Does my kind of interaction with my financial institution when I log into mobile banking or digital banking, that they serve up different pages eventually in the future, and everybody, just like that Netflix example I took, is everyone getting like a hyper-personalized experience?
Yeah, we're not yet in the level of producing that Netflix content custom to you. Mm-hmm. We're still in the stage of trying to get this industry to simply give you the recommendation for the next thing to watch on Netflix, right? Like Netflix is still a decade ahead of where financial services is, and that's probably being generous to this industry. But it's not just about what can you sell to the customer. And that's really important. We're really intentional about saying next best action, because it could be a user journey. It could be content in any way, shape, or form that's incredibly relevant to the customer at the right time, right place, right channel, that meets what they need right now. So now they trust you as their financial brand, and they want to do everything with you. And then when it is time that they need, whether it's a loan, a place to park their money, what card to use, where they're going to get rewards, et cetera, are they going to come to you? Well, if you're the one who's been helping them along the way, then yeah, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we increase cross-sell conversions. Like, there's no way around that. But if you start, if that's all you focus on, you miss the mark. And mm-hmm. I think that that's where kind of our predecessors in the industry, that's where they missed the mark, because it used to be a false choice between this shotgun offer of the month that every consumer account holder got the same offer every, you know, this month, and then every business account holder got the business offer that month, and that was it, right? And then all we did as an industry before us was, okay, how can we just change some of the copy and A-B test, like the creative, so that, oh, should we have this interest rate or that interest rate to trigger a conversion? And that's the wrong way to think about it. There's nothing wrong with thinking about that a little bit, but you're missing the mark, because most of your customers don't care about that offer of the month. Right? They have different things going on. Not everybody needs a loan today. So mm-hmm. don't focus on just telling them how great your lending is. Instead, figure out what they need and then determine how you can help them. And so that's what we do. We're uncovering from the transactions of each customer what's happening in their life and what they need next. Mm-hmm. Whether it is a cashback offer because they're buying a new pair of shoes, or maybe it is a mortgage, right? Or a business loan. But you know, it could be, it doesn't have to be just about selling a financial product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that piece is very important, right? The trusted advisor piece, right? Rather than just a product centric. So you're almost helping the financial institutions kind of take a customer centric approach to their interactions with them, telling them what they would be useful for them in many ways. And in some cases, that could be another product, but overarching, building that kind of relationship and the trusted. So there'll be more retention and of course, more product. So, no, that's awesome. Like in Money 2020, I don't know what you experienced, but I see a lot of AI talk this year, Gen AI talk, and how the use cases are early. I've interviewed some others who are focusing on other areas like credit decisioning. You're kind of focusing on hyper-personalization or personalization. What do you think are some of the challenges for incumbents or financial institutions or banks or others who are embarking on the AI journey? How do they kind of go around it? What are some impediments, and how is your approach different in helping that?
Oh, there's a lot to unpack in that question, Patty. So first, like let's think about what's keeping a big FI from doing this themselves, because I think that's kind of important. I think it's a few things. One, like anybody big, you know, there's always the argument that the big folks don't move fast enough. There's a lot of really smart people at Chase that can do a lot of things, right? So I don't think it's fair to underestimate what the big players are capable of. However, I think that especially when you're talking about data-driven use cases, where it's like you have to have really deep data analytics to then get whatever business outcome this is, what we found is the smartest people in data within financial institutions are focused on fraud, risk, or investing. And fair enough, right? Because the ROI on the investments there have existed for a long time, right? You certainly don't want fraud. If you're investing and you've got a lot of cash, like obviously that's a big deal. And underwriting and generating loans is also big, right? Like you don't want to have high default rates. And so I hesitate to always call it marketing, but like at the end of the day, the marketing department is typically who we're working with, right? Sometimes it's like the customer experience officer or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they don't always get the best data people, or they have a single data team that has to be is stretched between all of these different kind of functions within the org. And so it hasn't gotten the same focus, even historically, that us, like, that's all we do, right? That's why we don't get into credit decisioning. That's why we don't get into fraud. You could. There's other people who look at the very same data to go after those use cases. And yeah, it's the same data, but the way you analyze it is totally different, right? It's just a different set of domain knowledge. And like that, I think focus is the competitive advantage that we've got. But anyway, so that's why they don't, I think they're not doing it in-house today.
Mm-hmm.
There's still, though, broadly bigger issues, I think, that have to do with getting access to the data and what data you have, what data you don't have, and how that can kind of move around. And this is especially true when you get into the mid-market and down of financial institutions that historically haven't been able to get the data out of their cores. Now, a lot of that has changed, and we've done a lot so that it's funny. When we first launched our recommendation product, we assumed we would only work with banks that could stream data to us over API or over some other data streaming messaging service.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized that we don't need real-time data to deliver meaningful results. It's a little bit better. It's incrementally better. But even if I get data batched daily or weekly, we can still have a really big impact on how much the bank or credit union is able to do for their members, okay, and earn primacy, et cetera. So you know, we've kind of said, okay, we don't need the data pipeline to be perfect, right? We can work with what you have and still get meaningful results there. The other part, though, with the data is that banks don't always have, rarely have, a full 360 view of every customer,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, even just here, I've got a little tiny wallet that's magnetic on my phone, and I still have three credit cards in there and my driver's license, right? From three different banks, three different issuers. And so no one of them has visibility right now to all of my spending as a consumer, as a business owner, as a traveler, et cetera, right? And it's only now, really, over open banking rails that we're able to get, allow the consumer or the business owner to consent to share their data from the other, from all of their cards into singular places, wherever the customer wants to be primary. But so there's a lot of that that's only really happening now.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think the data piece, and obviously the larger institutions have put in a lot of kind of money into it. It seems like it's a little bit of infrastructure, like we had the warehouses, now we have mm-hmm. the lakes and whatnot, and some of the modern vendors, I think some of them were here yesterday, were talking about new architectures for how to kind of keep yeah. that data. And then there's the governance piece, right? So I think that's different levels of maturity is what I heard across different institutions. How do you come in? So if some organizations kind of less mature, so how do you kind of accommodate that with your approach? Because if you're reading bad data or not full data, incomplete data, then obviously the insights will suffer too, right? So how do you, what's your approach to kind of mitigate any deficiencies that the institutions might have on their data?
Yeah, sure. And I'll say, like, you could have the most up-to-date, forward-thinking data infrastructure. You probably still have ugly data. And you probably still have holes in that data, no matter how much money you're spending on Snowflake and AWS and everybody else out there. So really, it's what do you do with that messy data to clean it up? And that's where we start. So regardless of source of the transaction, it can be ACH and check and wires, or it could be card transactions from a processor, from open banking, doesn't matter. We have to start with cleaning up that data. And so part of our secret sauce is, or like the key to our methodology, is we look at where you're spending your money. And like, so who's the counterparty to every transaction in your ledger? And we build a profile of that counterparty based on public information. So the small mom and pop merchants, the way that your income comes in and the things that we can find out about your employer or your income sources from public information signals a ton about what makes you different than your next door neighbor, and that behavior changes over time. But anyway, so we need to know, and we need to be able to clearly identify with like high 90% levels of accuracy, like north of 97%, who the counterparty is. So then we can match them to what we know about all those counterparties, and that's how we build the profile. But it's clean. That's our secret sauce to clean up the data. right? From any source. But the other issue is, how do you fill in those data holes where you don't have that 360 view, and data infrastructure isn't going to magically fix that. Really, it's user journey that's going to fix that. It's having a reason for a customer to share their data with you for a reason that is valuable to them. Customers don't share data for fun, right? We've given all of our pictures to Meta because we want to share those pictures with our friends, not because we want it analyzed for who else is in them, right? But we had a reason to share the data, and now they've got it, right? And the same thing is when you're sharing, you know, one bank account's information with another bank. You're doing it because you want to move money. You're doing it because you want to see your financial health. You want to see all of your assets and liabilities in one place. You're doing it because you're applying for a loan. There's a whole bunch of really smart reasons to do it. And all we say is target the user, or ask the user to consent for you to also be able to match them with better and more relevant actions. That's it.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that's very smart. And thanks for sharing that, David. Kind of switching gears a little bit, one of the things Money 2020 does well is, kind of besides innovators, startups, incumbents, they bring in the regulators as well. And there were some kind of tracks around that. I didn't attend all of them. But I think AI is a particular focus for the regulators, especially CFPB. So have you been tracking that? Obviously, it's relevant for you, like how you use it. Have you been tracking that? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's probably two sets of regulations that are interesting and at different levels of kind of their life cycle. So the first is just the open banking regs that we just got some new guidance last week from the CFPB on what they call Rule 1033, which basically is saying that consumers own the rights to their financial data. Banks cannot charge for access or put up paywalls to access that data, and putting limitations into how that data can be used. So there's a lot of really interesting rules there. So for example, you can't use user data to target them with advertisements, for example, unless the user says you can. And advertising from like third parties is very different than matching them to the next thing from you. And so like they call out cross-selling separately from advertising. And the whole point is you have to be open and clear with the consumer what you're going to use the data for. And if you're using it for a secondary or third purpose, you have to be transparent right there, kind of top of the fold, telling them you're going to do this, not hidden inside your T's and C's. But anyway, so that's happening right now, and that's hot off the presses. The AI regs are, like, we still don't know what anyone's going to do, right? That's so fresh and new. Our approach right now is, and I don't know that this would, that it would take a lot for this to change. We don't pass any sensitive user data into any AI models. There's lots of ways to take advantage of awesome models without having to send data away to other people's servers. That's number one. I'm not doing that. And then number two, I can't put user data into a black box, because a lot of the regulations are going to require back testing that your results are not discriminatory, which matters a lot when you're putting a financial product in front of somebody. And then an audit trail of why a certain recommendation was made. And so if it's just a black box of why a financial recommendation was made, that's going to be problematic. However, I think that you can build auditable systems with the assistance of generative AI that is not a black box. Basically, your auditable system is created by or assisted in the creation by AI, but now you have the AI is kind of done, and now you have an auditable system that you can run data through that you can track just like you could any other kind of simpler algorithmic systems.
Gotcha. Yeah, this is interesting, and you seem to be well versed on it. So if I can kind of follow up a little bit. On the first one, the open banking, which I call the PSD2. I think the Europeans came out with PSD2 early on. I think it's kind of crossing the pond, so to speak, with those open banking regs. So that the privacy aspects or can use the data only with permission, that impacts kind of what you are doing indirectly in many ways, right? Obviously, it doesn't impact, say, the tech companies. Google and Facebook don't need to do that, although they have some privacy regulations, but not as stringent as, say, the regulated companies. So, but what is the workaround? So if people opt out, then that kind of prevents them from kind of getting personalized experience, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think it ends up being not dissimilar from GDPR. Mm-hmm. So if you say no to cookies everywhere on the internet and you're always in incognito mode, you don't have any relevant experiences. Your feed, your New York Times feed isn't going to be good if you're never logged in, et cetera. But as part of your user onboarding, you're consenting to them using your data, and financial data in this case is working just the same way of saying, yeah, you can use this to better target more personalized information and offers to me and advice to me, mm-hmm. right? And so all the rules are doing is, again, it's very similar to GDPR, where you're putting it in front of the customer to say what you're doing and why. Mm-hmm. And so like we've been GDPR compliant for a while now, and we've got customers over in Europe. And so the model makes sense to us, right? It doesn't bug us. And we've been, because of the way that we deploy of focusing on what's the next action for the user rather than just how to sell them more shit, candidly, we've got customers that are like, hey, we want to put your more actionable advice as the reason that a user should link in the first place, not as like a second reason, but like the whole reason to link your accounts is to figure out like what cashback offers are you missing out on, or where could you earn more interest or whatever, right? So like rather than saying, okay, how do we work around it and, you know, have just the right language so that consumers don't opt out, it's now the whole reason that the consumers are even getting this far is because they want this output. Some people will opt out, right? Because they don't want anything shared. Fine, right? Same thing happens on the internet. And that's okay, right? But I'll tell you, when I'm watching, we watch a lot of Hulu and I'm too cheap to pay for no ads. And I hate when the ads are not relevant to me. Like, I don't have these medical conditions. These ads can be targeted to me. I've got plenty of other conditions, I'm sure. Target me for what's wrong with me rather than for some skin condition that I've never heard of and nobody in my family has.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah, no, thanks. And on AI, like that explainable construct you said, right? The white box kind of explain what you're doing. So have you kind of faced that? I'm kind of almost wondering how that examination, so if the regulators are going to examine, right, like the institution that's using your model, for example. So what does that entail? They look at the model, they feed it some test data and see what it kind of generates or decides, or how does that examination look like?
I think the best model is, we don't know yet, but I think the best model to look at are current credit decisioning models that are already pretty complicated and proprietary. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to reveal the scoring of everything inside your model, but you need to identify if certain attributes were considered that you're not allowed to consider. So did you affirmatively take in and use data to make a decision that you're not allowed to do, right? That's discriminatory for one reason or another. And then the other thing that they do is they look at the results. And are the results just ex post facto discriminatory, even though it wasn't intentional, but there was an unintentional bias in the algorithm or in the data, right? And so I think that you have to show at least those two. The issue with generative AI, unlike previous ML deployments and the stuff that we've been doing for years, is that it has data sources in those models that you can't point to because you don't know about them. And so if they're included and you don't know how or why it just came out, you can't point to where, you can't take it out, right? Until it's too late. And that just makes it really complicated to fix. That's not to say you can't fix it. But I suspect that we're also going to see, and you're seeing some of this on Llama now, where you're stripping down that model into kind of smaller submodels that are highly performant, that can run on mobile, that you're having now control over what data did go in. And now it's like, okay, cool. There were no intentional attributes that came in that you weren't allowed to use, right? But if it's a broad model that's just scraping the web for everything and it looked up information about this user and things they were posting on social that indicated like religion or race or other sorts of things that we cannot include, and somehow it did, that's problematic as hell, right?
Gotcha. No. Kind of switching gears into where do you go from here? What's the future for FinGoal? You've kind of built and you're working with customers and partners. So where do you go from here?
Yeah, that's a great question. Looking years out, right now we don't build any of the creative, like any of the actual offer that goes out to the user. We're just identifying and flagging what they have a high propensity for and giving the propensity scores. And I think in the near term, some of our more innovative partners that then take that data to drive smarter campaigns are deploying generative AI soon. Like they've got it in beta, right? Selling that kind of product to FIs is a little nerve-wracking to the FI. So figuring out how to do those things, and I mean like I'm telling you things about the customer. For example, I'll tell you that this customer is a small business owner who owns a food truck that sells salads, right? And so using generative AI to build creative, showing somebody running a food truck that has salads, right? That sort of thing, right? And so there's folks starting to build that. Like we integrate, for example, in MailChimp today. And a surprising number of banks and credit unions use MailChimp, and they've got you can build Gen AI campaigns in MailChimp. Taking that though and into the bank specific tools and getting banks to do that is going to take a little while, but I think that that's next. For us, I think that we still have a lot. There's a lot of green field ahead in analyzing transactions for attributes, life events, what's next.
Mm-hmm.
I get really excited as brands are doing, as financial brands are now offering other things that aren't financial products so they can do more for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really, really interesting. I think pay by bank, this isn't an AI topic, but as telecoms and media companies are allowing consumers to pay through their bank account instead of a card,
mm-hmm.
That's now an opportunity. Let's say Comcast gives you $10 back every month in exchange for you sharing their data so that they can better target you for the commercials on Peacock, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
That's only happening like literally now-ish. Like Comcast doesn't make that available today because they don't have they don't have open banking pay by bank, but they could, right? And all of their ilk. They've got a lot of like large amounts of recurring low risk payments, and now they're using open banking to make those payments, and that's the data that we need as the lifeblood so that you can better target other things to them, again with their consent, right? You have to have their consent in. It's got to be clear, it's got to be transparent, there can be no confusion about what's happening here, and the user has to have control to turn it off at any time, right? But consumers will share it if you make it worth their while, right? We do it all the time. Anyway, so I think like in the near term, next couple of years, that's what's going to be happening. Looking further out, I see that there will probably be roll-ups in our space between. So I know that you chatted earlier today and this week with folks in fraud and in underwriting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really cool use cases that look at the very same data that we do, that sell to the same FIs that we do,
mm-hmm.
around creditworthiness and fraud. Now, the models are wildly different. The way you deploy them is wildly different, right? But at the end of the day, it's the same data in, it's the same customers you're selling to. And it makes sense that in a few years, there's going to be some roll-ups happening there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that just makes sense. Right now, though, there's so much work in building the models that the work is still too immature for the roll-ups to happen yet, mm-hmm. right? But they will.
Yeah. That's great. That's a good roadmap. You have your work cut out for a couple of years and more. In closing, anything you want to add? Where can people find you on social media if you want to give out X, LinkedIn, or whatnot, and more information about FinGoal?
Yeah, FinGoal.com. I'm easy to find on Twitter X, just FinGoal David. And on LinkedIn, I'm David Nohe. You'll find me. If you look up Nohe as a no, he didn't, I'm probably the first face you're going to see. It's got white glasses. Yeah, and I end every interview by asking folks to just sign up to be an organ donor. And if you can, give blood. I donated an organ a couple years ago, and it had a major impact, not just on, obviously, the recipient's life, but it was a big deal to me. That's not right for everybody, but you can still sign up to be an organ donor at the end, right? So do that. Thanks.
Awesome, David. That's a great way to end. Thank you for being on the FinTech Talk Show.
Thank you. It's been awesome to be here. Thanks, Patty.
Okay. Bye.
Welcome, FinTech Talkers, to another edition of the FinTech Talk Show, recorded live at Money 2020 in Las Vegas. I'm your host, Patty. My impressions from Money 2020 so far is that FinTech is evolving into FinTel, that is Fin plus intelligence, or AI. It's early time, but just like OpenAI's in banking altered distribution, blockchain had the potential of altering infrastructure and central bank function, AI and Gen AI fundamentally can alter how consumers and businesses manage their finances and the roles bankers, loan officers, and advisors play. I'm doing a series in the early use cases of AI, and my guest today is Leslie Gillen. She's the Chief Growth Officer at Pagaya. Pagaya's AI technology enables lenders to offer credit to a wider range of applicants without increasing risk. Welcome, Leslie, to FinTech Talk.
Thanks, Patty. It's great to be here.
Awesome. So before we get into Pagaya and how AI is going to change the world, Leslie, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I, as the Chief Growth Officer, I work with many partners and investors, and our job is really to expand the credit for many people and consumers for our partners. And why I'm so excited about being here is because I spent 30 years in the financial services space. I most recently was at JP Morgan Chase as the Chief Marketing Officer of the firm, and then I ran the co-brand cards business, working with many merchants who were never happy about their approval rates. For their customers, which I can touch on. And then before that, I was the global chief marketing officer of Citi. So I've been around banking for a long time, and really what Pagaya does is solve a lot of the challenges that banks have today in serving their customers.
Awesome. So you know where the skeletons are, so to speak. And a recovering banker, I've worked in banking as we were talking before the started recording. Maybe just touch on that as to how is it different, right? Working in corporate banking, and now you're working with banks, but in a startup. So how's that change?
Yeah, it's not as dramatic a change. I think what is a big change is the speed that we can move in the fintech space, the technology space. But what is exciting, and because I was working at banks for many years, fintechs used to be more enemies than they became frenemies. They were threats, and today they're very much seen as enablers. So to me, I take a lot of pride in that, and I'm excited because I actually know the challenges on the bank side. Many amazing people that work in banks every day, but because it's such a highly regulated function, especially underwriting, and the structure of the data in many of these institutions for a very long period of time, they struggle. They struggle with the ability to be able to see consumers a more holistic view, and so many people just fall through the cracks as it relates to underwriting.
No, great. I do want to kind of drill down into that, maybe broadly talk a little bit about AI first. As I said in the introduction, kind of I see fintech, at least the impression I get about Money 2020, fintech's kind of morphing into fintel, or a lot of people are talking about early adoption of AI. You have a very interesting credit use case, which is bread and butter, and with the focus on that inclusion as well. But what do you see kind of as a big picture on AI? Is it still early stages? Are we just scratching the surfaces on its applications? Where do you see that going? And you can contextualize it to Pagaya as well.
Yeah. So as you know very well, AI has been around for a long time. It's not like it was here yesterday. Obviously, ChatGPT has made it seem like it just showed up. But it's been around for a long time. It's been around for chatbots and servicing. It's been around for fraud. Underwriting is relatively new, and mainly because it's just a very highly regulated as it relates to the use of data and data bias and such. And so when you think about what happened during COVID and post-George Floyd and the mandate for banks to do more and bring more people into the mainstream economy. I think many people recognize that it's time to really lean in. And also, by the way, it wasn't just for that purpose. Fintechs were kind of eating banks' lunch as it relates to leveraging AI. In fact, 70% of personal loans today are not happening with banks. They're happening with fintechs. So AI, I think the good news is everybody sees it's a necessity, especially it's not only about bringing more people in the mainstream economy, it's about good business. And I think what we're seeing, and I'm lucky to work with many partners today, including banks, they see the value in what we're able to bring forward because of doing it and having a more holistic view of a consumer versus going through many binary cuts or, you know, linear regression type models where you're just missing a number of people.
Gotcha. And 70%, that's interesting. So that's what you'd expect banks to do well, but they're leaving a lot on the table. And there's a risk issue maybe, but it's business on the table, money on the table, so to speak. So let's talk a little bit. So how did you end up with this problem? Maybe I think it might be based on what you saw when you were working in the banks. And how are you solving it?
Yeah. So if you think about banks, there's a couple of things. One is the data itself. And many banks, even if they have four or five asset classes, their data is siloed. So there may have a mortgage business and a credit card business and a deposit business. And sometimes, whether a customer has a different address or there's a G in the middle initial and not, you miss a holistic view of a customer. The other piece of it is that banks tend to be more insular because they're looking at the data within their institution, where when you're working with a Pagaya, for example, we work with over 26 lenders, and we have a strategic relationship with TransUnion. And so when you think about the AI that we're leveraging, banks are able to benefit because, similar to a bureau, they're able to see across like the whole industry how people are actually, you know, if they're eligible for credit or should be eligible for credit. But what we're able to do, because of having thousands of variables behind a FICO score, so think about our relationship with TransUnion. We have over a decade of consumer credit bureau data in production. And so when we work with an individual lending partner, we get in real time the application, but then we have all of this data in production, along with our ability to have models that have trained over a period of time across four asset classes. So we just have a lot of expertise, and the AI itself enables you to round out a consumer, because instead of having a FICO score, a proprietary score, and then some binary cuts like most underwriting models do today, we are able to bring all of that, all of the variables behind the FICO score into a decision in real time. And so you're able to just see people. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. So many times a bank won't approve somebody if they have a debt to income ratio of over 30%. So we see people who may have a 40% debt to income in that moment, but we're able to see that they have 5 years of pristine history. That's something that when you have a binary cut in an underwriting platform, that's, you're missing a swath of people. So many times people are thinking Pagaya is only approving people that are less than 660. But yet we're finding people all the way up and down the spectrum. Bankruptcy is another thing. If somebody was bankrupt, but we can see a more holistic view because of the thousands of the variables. The other thing that we do with our partners is we train each model is trained to be customized for our partners, but we're leveraging a base amount of data, which is also FCRA compliant, which is very important to banks. So you also hear a lot of scrutiny on AI and alternative data being used, and there's obviously the regulators are paying attention to what's happening. But Pagaya, we've actually chosen to only use FCRA compliant data so that banks are more comfortable to first the data that's being leveraged and then allowing them to get more comfortable with leveraging the AI capability itself.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, very interesting. And And I almost want to draw an analogy while you were talking. You're almost like the Plaid or Plaid of for lending, right? In many ways, you're aggregating loan, and obviously bureaus do that, but you're kind of putting a layer, AI or model layer on top of it, and you have that visibility. That's awesome. In terms of that inclusion piece, so obviously you talked about debt to income ratios and things like that, and you can kind of see that in many ways because you have access to other data. But looks like you're impacting folks who don't get credit much. Talk a little bit about that. Was that intentional, or was that almost a side effect of what you're doing?
Yeah, no, it was definitely intentional. And because there was such a need that was obvious. So if you think about it, 42% of consumers today are getting declined for an application for credit, or they're not getting all the credit that they're looking for, 42%. And so clearly there's friction in the system, and that obviously, we actually started as an asset management company in 2016. And so when you think about Pagaya and what we do, we are a two-sided network. We have over 100 institutional investors, private bank clients, and we work in the ABS markets on one side of the network that's bringing capital to the table. And what's exciting about that is the investors want to invest in the consumer for a strong return on asset. And so it's not just about the AI decision making that Pagaya brings to the table. We're also bringing capital. Hmm. Why that's important is because we're facilitating the ability for loans that banks are still not comfortable with having on their balance sheet, and we're facilitating them being purchased in daily cash settlements. So we're able to, like working with an SoFi or an Ally or a number of our partners, we have over 26 lenders on the platform, and so they basically, if they are declining an application, they ping us in real time, and it's in milliseconds through an open API. We come back with a recommendation to approve, mm-hmm. based on the AI and what we're solving for return on asset for the investor, and then the economics that we share with the partner. And our job is to approve as many of those customers as possible. And we're approving about 20%, 20 to 25% of the declines. We're able to turn around into an approval because we can see the opportunity. And when we talk about opportunity, to your question, it's a big deal. So we right now, 37% of those loans that we turn around are Black and Latinx. Mm-hmm. One out of two of them are female, who otherwise were going to be turned down for a product they were looking for. And what's really exciting is about 50% are low to moderate income. And so when you think about the inclusion impact, besides it being very good business, and it gives us the ability to help banks and lenders deepen existing relationships, it's also enabling people to, you know, be brought into the mainstream economy versus alternatives, which with high fees and payday lending and those types of things. So so that's what's very exciting about what we bring to the table.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. And I didn't know that part, that you lend as well. And that's a great model because you don't have the acquisition cost, right? You get a free lead gen almost. So that's fantastic. And you're able to kind of lend, I think you said 20-25% of those declines. Kind of switching back, because I'm kind of focusing on use cases in AI in financial services. What do you see as big impediments for banks to adopt more smarts like this, AIs, and not just not for decisioning, but for other functions, but definitely for underwriting as well? So what do you think are some of the impediments today?
Yeah, I think what I would say, there were mainly three impediments, and what I'm excited about is that there's work being done on all three, but the speed is part of the challenge, right? Because there's people every day that are getting declined that should be eligible for a credit product, especially somebody who needs a car, an auto loan for them to get to work, and they can't get a loan. And so that's, you know, just one example, mm-hmm. that we bring to the table. So when you think about three, there's data. So the inability to have structured data that's more complete for an individual. There's, and I would say AI, I'll come back to the impact that AI brings, because even though if you have good data. You know, the AI models themselves are add a lot of a benefit. Mm-hmm. Two is the technology capability. And it's not just the capability, it's the fact that many of these banks have a huge tech debt. And so they have, they have finite tech dollars. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the prioritization, that's also a big challenge. So you have the data challenge, you have the technology mm-hmm. investment and capability. And then third is the regulatory aspect. What I'm very excited about, and I think the CFPB over the past literally 60 days has addressed two different new guidelines or rules that they're working on. One, as it relates to transparency of an adverse action notice when using AI. What's mm-hmm. so exciting about that is that the AI, the CFPB is writing regulation about how to use AI. Hmm. They're leaning into recognizing that AI is something that's very necessary for banks to be able to better serve their customers. And it's proven. AI has moved forward in many aspects of the life cycle of being a banking customer, and underwriting I think is definitely the next frontier because we're here.
Gotcha. No, it's definitely interesting, and looks like you're very looped into all the regulatory kind of changes, and CFPB is taking a very active role and looking into how AI should be used, which is very good. I think there are things like the Fair Lending Act and all, so AI should kind of honor or be compliant, and you should be able to show as a lender that you are, and that's important. So where do we go from here? So what's next for Pagaya? Are you kind of getting more banks, or like the model you have, you can serve the decline, so you have kind of a lending business as well, you have a balance sheet, and talk a little bit about which is bigger, the licensing business of the banks or your balance sheet on lending, or both are growing, and where do you go next from here? You stay in lending, or like a lot of the monoline fintechs that expand to multi-line, getting into other things? And also, we didn't touch on this, Leslie, in terms of the loans, you mentioned auto loans and stuff. So what type of loans do you typically cover today?
Yeah. So today, we operate in four consumer asset classes. So we started with personal loans, mm-hmm. And we then moved into auto. And so we have 12 auto lenders, Ally, Westlake, a number of auto partners. And then we're in the payments lending, so credit card and point of sale. Point of sale is unbelievable how it's exploded. It's mm-hmm. the fastest growing asset class, unsecured lending asset class, with almost one out of two consumers in the U.S. already having done some type of point of sale or BNPL, buy now, pay later. And so that's really expanding. And so we just partnered with Klarna at the end of last year in the point of sale space. But I can tell you there are a number of banks. It's the fastest growing asset class within banks today. So we're in those asset classes, leveraging our AI capability and bringing that capital to the table. And then when you ask, where are we going from here? We're definitely focused right now. We are talking to 80 of the top 25 banks, 80%, sorry, 80% of the top 25 banks. We're in some level of discussion, and we've already brought on a few, including a very large one that we'll be able to be talking more about soon. Mm-hmm. So serving banks and auto captives. We also are, we've been serving many lenders and banks in the auto space, but also working towards those auto captives, which is another space. So that's what we're focused on in the immediate term. But Pagaya, there's a lot we can do with the AI across a number of different verticals, and it's also portable in a number of different geographies. So we're really just getting started.
Gotcha. And U.S. focused, I take it, Leslie, you're not focusing in international markets yet?
Yeah. For now, we are 100% focused. Our clients, we have investors from around the globe, but the lending side and the consumer and the decision making that we're doing leveraging the AI is all in the U.S. In fact, all of our infrastructure, all of our data is all U.S. based.
Gotcha. And I didn't know about that BNPL, or as CFPB wants us to say, installments instead of BNPL.
Right.
I didn't know that part. You had that covered. And that's interesting that I've covered the Square Afterpay. It's been like a couple of years, I think, when they acquired. And definitely there's the interest component of that installment business. But there's also, I think, Afterpay's economics, if I remember this right, I might not get the exact number, but they were almost 3.5% their revenue was off their gross merchandise volume, whereas Square at that time when they acquired, there was just the usual 1.5% of their gross payment volume for their payments business. So that BNPL, and this was not even interest because Afterpay did not have interest. So it was a very interesting kind of model with the BNPL or the installments, because I think it taps into the merchants or the businesses' marketing budget rather than just the payments budget, and in some case financing or interest income. So that I think that's an interesting asset class, and you see that growing for Pagaya?
Yeah, we do. And it's interesting in the space. So to your point, there's buy now, pay later. And obviously that data, there's a lot of discussion because that's not really in the credit bureaus today. And that's where there's a lot of focus. But we've been, even with Klarna, even though they do buy now, pay later, most pay point of sale growth is really in merchant installment loans. And so to your point, what's exciting about the economics of that is that there's the sharing of the MDR, or the merchant discount rate, which enables, in fact, many of our partners choose to not make the revenue, and they'd rather pour that back into incremental approval rates so that more people can purchase and participate. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, that's better for the merchants, it's better for the consumer, it's better for the economy. And so, you know, we're finding that that's you know, working really well, and it's creating a win-win-win for the banks that are partnered with the merchants, and then of course the consumer at the end of the day. And then you add on top of it the financial inclusion benefit, which is so important.
Yeah. No, awesome. And shifting gears a little bit, we're at Money 2020 in Vegas, so I want you to share some kind of thoughts on it. It's been about a day and a half. I don't know when you arrived, but
last night.
Maybe just a half a day of conference for you so far. Share what do you think some of the streams that you see at Money 2020, the evolution of fintech?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot, even though we're talking about this, there's a lot more about AI that I see, and about regulators. I feel like, and I've been coming here over the past 3 years, the difference between regulators, fintechs, banks, merchants, everybody's up on stage and everybody's collaborating together. It's very exciting, because by the way, that's the only way that we're actually gonna make, you know, really force accelerate change at a more rapid pace. But I feel like everybody's, all the different constituents are rowing in the same direction. Instead of trying to figure each other out, whether it's the banks and the fintechs, or the fintechs and the regulators, and so that to me is very exciting, because it's starting to feel like there's a common agenda. You know, and again, as I talked about before, having the regulators really participate. We have the OCC here, the CFPB here, and they're leaning in and they're giving their point of view and their vast experience and point of view, because they see everything across lenders and they know what they're, look, you know, it's the regulation is very important, especially as we're leveraging data, you're making sure that you have financial inclusion, there needs to be a balance. And so I feel like this year, more than anything, I can already see like people are feeling like they are understanding the sandbox that everybody's playing in, which I think will enable us to all make more progress more quickly. Mm-hmm.
No, that is true, and Money 2020 has a good job, has done a good job over the years to including them in the process. I think innovation regulators need to be involved early on rather than later on. That's been good. I already asked you about what's next for Pagaya, but in closing, anything else you want to share, Leslie?
Well, I just think you know, one thing when you think about Pagaya or even fintechs more broadly is, especially when there's a macro environment challenge like there is today, even though we may not be going into a recession, but there's just a lot, you know, whether it's the interest rates, et cetera, when there's challenge, you know, it's the best time to be on the Pagaya network. It's the best time to be leaning in and working with fintechs that don't have antiquated systems that can enhance, not compete. It's not a competing. It's really about how can we all enhance the ecosystem, the financial services and banking ecosystem, for the broadest consumer base that we can. And so we always say the best time to be on the Pagaya network is in times like this, because as lenders are pulling back, we can help them, you know, go deeper. And the last thing I would say, which is so exciting about financial inclusion, we're starting to see the benefit for consumers. A few of our partners, we did an analysis, and 15% of the consumers that are approved because of Pagaya's AI decision capability, 1 year later, they're being approved from that same lender that declined them a year earlier.
Wow.
So that's very cool. And so I'm just very excited and thrilled to be part of Money 2020 through and really partnering and looking forward to partnering with many banks, financial institutions, and regulators going forward.
No, that's very cool. And that inclusion piece is really, it probably gives you fulfillment, meaning it's really impactful, right? So that's really cool. So how can folks find you, Leslie? You're on social if you want to give out LinkedIn and other Twitter or X now. How can people find more information about you or Pagaya?
Yes. Please email me, leslie@pagaya.com, go to www.pagaya.com, follow us on X, on LinkedIn, Instagram, we're out there, and hopefully, you know, we'll work soon with many more of you and continue to make needed progress to bring more people into the mainstream economy. So thanks for having me today, Patty.
Sure, thank you, Leslie. So Pagaya and Leslie, a lot of breakthroughs in AI and financial services, as well as inclusion. So check them out. Thank you, Leslie, for being on the FinTech Talk Show.
Thank you.